This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, September 20, 2002. From Pacifica Station WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. The Bush administration releases its doctrine of striking foes first, while justifying the U.S. to have a far advanced military arsenal than any other country. Undocumented workers in New York City grocery stores win rights to better working conditions. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Bush administration announced that it will consider scaling back the federal government's ability to enforce the Clean Water Act. Gareth Schweitzer reports from Washington.
Yesterday's announcement by Environmental Protection Agency and Army Corps of Engineers officials follows a 5-4 Supreme Court ruling last year that limited the scope of the Clean Water Act to navigable waters and adjoining wetlands. Prior to that decision, the government had interpreted the Clean Water Act to include non-navigable waterways. Joan Mulhern, Legislative Counsel for Earth Justice, believes that without federal protection, clean water policy could be set back by decades.
This is shredding that policy. It's going back before the Reagan era. It's going back to the pre-1970s, before we had an Environmental Protection Agency.
The Clean Water Act was passed in 1977 to empower the federal government to protect the integrity of the nation's already deteriorating waters. Partial jurisdiction could now be passed to the states, some of which have no laws regulating pollution of their waterways. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
Just two buildings of Yasser Arafat's entire compound remain in the headquarters of the Palestinian president this afternoon. Awad Duwabis is in Ramallah.
Less than 8 hours after the suicide bombing in Tel Aviv that killed 6 Israelis, Israeli tanks were entering and destroying what was left of the compound of Yasser Arafat. The Israeli cabinet decided to isolate Arafat once again in the besieged city of Ramallah, but Israeli Defense Minister Benjamin Ben-Eliezer said the Israeli government has no intention to expel the Palestinian leader. Meanwhile, in the Gaza Strip, 3 Palestinians, including a 15-year-old boy, were killed, and 2 Israeli soldiers were injured in Israeli incursions, mainly in Rafah in the southern of Gaza. And in the West Bank, Palestinian cities are still under tight siege and curfew, and have been for several days. This is Awad Davis reporting for Free Speech Radio News, Ramallah.
Under threat from the Bush administration, Iraq's foreign minister defended his country before the United Nations General Assembly. Susan Wood reports from the UN.
Foreign Minister Naji Sabri denied Iraq was in violation of UN Security Council resolutions. Sabri pledged his government's full cooperation with the UN Monitoring, Verification, and Inspection Commission. Speaking to reporters last night, Hans Blix, chair of UNMOVIC, said he would discuss practical arrangements for resuming inspections with Iraqi authorities in Vienna on September 30th. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
The city of New York has agreed to pay millions of dollars to homeless families for denying them shelter. From New York, Jeff Brady has this report.
The city agreed to pay off millions in fines that have accrued since 1995, when it accepted to pay $100 per night for each family not placed in a shelter, but instead spent the night on benches at the Bronx Emergency Assistance Unit, or EAU. While it's not immediately clear what the total payment will be, Steve Banks, a Legal Aid Society lawyer representing homeless families, estimates a total close to $5 million. Families such as Michelle Pearson and her 2 children may soon be reimbursed for having to stay overnight at the EAU.
I had to sleep in there all night. Rats in there, it's roaches in there, it's mice in there. I mean, it's nasty in there. So would you want to live there with your children, having the chance for a rat to bite them, roaches to bite you? Because I don't know what this is that bit me.
Where?
You know, on my leg. You know? It's really stressful.
This is the second time in 7 years the city has been forced to pay such fines. New York City has been under court order since 1986 to provide shelter to homeless families. In another contentious issue, the city also agreed to comply with a court order to close a former jail currently used as an overflow for sheltering homeless families. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jeff Brady in New York.
A divided federal appeals court ruled a South Carolina law allowing state inspectors access to all abortion clinic records does not violate patients' privacy rights. Jack Hickey has more.
The decision overturns a Greenville District Court finding largely favorable to the abortion clinic.
regarding a state regulation that undermines the ability of providers to operate. The 2-to-1 holding at the Circuit Court of Appeals has four parts: giving police access to patient records, mandating clinic provisions of religious counseling, requiring every abortion to have an emergency on-call hospital physician, and allowing the state to mandate dozens of specific requirements for how to set up the clinic, from how big the ventilators are to how wide each doorway is. From the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, this is Jack Hickey for Free Speech Radio News.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
President Bush announced today he plans to go ahead with his war against Iraq with or without the support from the United Nations. The announcement came as George Bush released the National Security Strategy of the United States, which formally links his war on terrorism with global capitalism and calls for a policy of preemptive war around the world. This, as Saddam Hussein yesterday told the United Nations that Iraq is free of nuclear, biological and chemical weapons, and accused the US of trying to gain control of Middle East oil and ultimately the entire world. Aaron Glantz has this report.
The National Security Plan released by the Bush administration today states the U.S. has no intention to allow any foreign power to catch up with the, quote, huge lead the U.S. has opened since the fall of the Soviet Union a decade ago. The report indicates a final goodbye to Cold War diplomacy, an entrance into preemptive, unilateral use of force. Speaking to reporters today, President Bush reiterated Iraq is his first target.
And if the United Nations Security Council won't deal with the problem, the United States and some of our friends will. That's the message the Secretary of State has delivered forcefully. It's a message that he will continue to carry.
The security plan indicates the Bush administration will continue to pull out of landmark international treaties it disagrees with. Already, President Bush has pulled the U.S. out of the Kyoto Treaty on Global Warming, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, and the treaty creating the International Criminal Court. Basil Fernando is with the Asian Human Rights Commission, based in Hong Kong.
There has been hundreds of years of debate on internationalism, and the international law has been built on this. So the exceptions that the United States is taking in recent times in the international law, like the International Criminal Court, now asking for more exceptions, will jeopardize the entire project of human rights in the world.
The plan calls for increased support for what the Bush administration calls moderate and modern Muslim governments to ensure that the conditions and ideologies that promote terrorism do not find fertile ground in any nation. In Pakistan, Fernando notes, that's meant massive U.S. support for the military dictatorship of General Pervez Musharraf.
In Pakistan, in the name of democracy, they have put in place a man who is going to destroy, and is destroying, the entire foundation of democracy. A military form of government will seep into all areas of life in Pakistan. And, it is sad to happen because these people, Pakistani people, have made enormous sacrifices for democracy. And today, the small minority in the United States, represented by Mr. Bush, is destroying the gains that are made by the people on the front of democracy and human rights.
The report also links the war on terrorism to what it calls the fight to create free markets and free trade. It says the U.S. intends to use the World Bank and International Monetary Fund in what it calls a battle for the future of the Muslim world. The Bush administration calls its plan distinctly American internationalism. Susan George of the French anti-globalization group ATTAC hopes European governments will stand up to what she calls the Bush regime.
I think he's determined, no matter what Iraq does, but he is going to sour world public opinion even more. So I don't want the Iraqis to suffer, that's for sure. But sometimes I think it is going to take something like that to finally galvanize the Europeans into understanding what this regime is. Okay. And I hope that there might be a tiny, tiny silver lining, because this man is really, I mean, he is something else. Nixon, next to him, was a flaming leftist radical.
But if the international community opposes Bush and his plan, Bush says he'll move ahead with whatever coalition he has left. And he says if the United Nations doesn't go along, he'll move to marginalize the UN.
I think you're going to see a lot of nations love freedom. They understand the threat. They understand that the credibility of the United Nations is at stake. They heard me loud and clear when I said either you can be the United Nations, a capable body, a body able to keep the peace, or you can be the League of Nations. And we're confident that people will follow our lead.
With Patrick Beckett in Copenhagen, I'm Aaron Glantz for Free Speech Radio News.
U.S.-German relations are showing signs of large cracks with just 2 days to go before the federal elections take place in Germany. The current Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder has been campaigning with a strong stance against an American invasion of Iraq, and now one of his justice ministers has compared the methods of Bush to those of Hitler. In turn, U.S. Senator Jesse Helms has proposed that Congress should consider withdrawing U.S. forces from their bases in Germany if Schroeder wins re-election in Germany and fails to join a, quote, constructive dialogue on Iraq. With more on this story, Jeremiah Luna reports from Berlin.
This Sunday, public transportation will be open for all passengers in Berlin to encourage voters to go to the polls on Election Day. Some 66 million voters, or 75% of the voting population, are expected to vote, a high percentage when compared to the average American turnout of 45%. The current Bundeschancellor Gerhard Schroeder of the Social Democratic Party has in the last week captured a small lead against his main adversary, Edmund Stoiber of the Christian Democratic Union. Stoiber, the minister-president from the state of Bavaria, has campaigned with a focus on the economy. Nevertheless, for the most part of this election year, Stoiber has held a steady lead in the polls, preaching Republican-like slogans against the welfare state and the evils of big government. Alexander King, an academic employee of the German parliament, says,
Schröder lag in den Meinungsumfragen weit abgeschlagen.
Schroeder has been behind in the polls because many Germans felt that if he failed to come through on his election promise to sufficiently reduce the number of unemployed, the introduction of the euro was also a disaster which caused a sharp onset of inflation at the time when Germany and the world were experiencing economic slowdown. But most of all, Schroeder's cuts to our social programs like health care, his privileging of the industrialists, and privatization of pensions have given many the impression that he has succumbed to the pitfalls of neoliberalist policies.
Schroeder's last-minute comeback has been largely due to his separating himself from Bush's Iraq rhetoric. For the first time, foreign policy is playing a major role in a German federal election. By stating that his government will not support a possible military action against Iraq, Chancellor Schroeder has found a very strong resonance for peace in the German public. Many in the German government and the mainstream press have charged that Schroeder would likely reverse his anti-Iraq war stance after he's re-elected, and that he will somehow find a way to allow Germany to join the Americans in their military action. Alexander King, who works with the German parliament.
The Schroeder government has continued to enlarge and restructure the current German military in order that it can be more quickly and effectively stationed in crisis regions around the world. The Schroeder government continues to help arm Turkey, regardless of the continuing civil war taking place there against the Kurdish population. It is guilty of war crimes which took place during the NATO bombing of Yugoslavia. Only now, 1 or 2 weeks before the elections, that Schroeder has tried to assume the role of peacemaker.
The Bush-appointed U.S. diplomatic representative to Germany, Daniel Coats, has already gone out of his way to publicly chastise the chancellor during a time of intense election campaigning, saying that, under Gerhard Schroeder's leadership, Germany is being led down a path of isolation within the EU and is in danger of worsening relations with the USA. Coates' remarks seem to have fueled a debate here in Germany, where most Germans have sided with their chancellor. Dr. Helmut Edinger, deputy head of the Department of International Relations for the Party of Democratic Socialism, says that he supports Schroeder's rhetoric on the Iraq crisis, but says that it does not go far enough.
Until now, there is no practical step showing that the German government really will stick to this position and will do something about it. Its administration clearly that there will be no consent to use German territory for such a war, for such an attack, for such actions, because there are a lot of American bases on German soil which have been used in the Gulf War, for instance, 10 years ago.
On top of this, Dr. Helmut Edinger says that to be taken seriously as a supporter of peace, Chancellor Schroeder needs to attempt to organize opposition to a possible American war against Iraq within the EU. If Stoiber wins the election, the Bush administration will have gained an important ally, while if Schroeder wins, Germany and the world will be eager to see what happens next. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jeremiah Luna, reporting from Berlin.
Following a year-long negotiation, nearly 24 Korean groceries in New York City pledged earlier this week to honor an historic code of conduct. The code is intended to better protect a largely undocumented male Mexican workforce at some 2,000 neighborhood stores. Brokered by New York's Attorney General Elliot Spitzer, this landmark agreement was created to end what critics charge are brutal sweatshop conditions, including 72-hour workweeks, below minimum wage pay, no overtime, and no benefits of any kind. FSRN's Eileen Sutton has more.
For 9 years, Manuel Carlos Montesinos worked with 20 others at a grocery store in Manhattan's busy Midtown. He tried to support a wife and four children on $300 a week, working 11 hours a day. He says when the workers signed union cards, the owner, claiming business had fallen, sold the store and fired them. Montesinos said he got little beyond his paycheck.
In 9 years, no vacation, no days, no paper days, holidays. Days for, sick, for enfermedad. Okay. My boss no pay nothing.
While not a union contract per se, the new code potentially guarantees the minimum wage for 14,000 workers citywide. They will now get 1 day off a week, a 30-minute lunch, some paid sick days, and 1 week's paid vacation after a year. Yet workers can still be fired without cause. There is no holiday pay, no health coverage, and no scheduled wage increases. Owners who sign on to the code by December 31, 2002, agree to be monitored at least twice a year, and the state will not pursue them for back wages. A lawyer by trade and a vice president for the Korean American Association of New York, Sam An, suggested the Korean owners, who control 80% of New York's green groceries, are misunderstood.
The green grocers are under a lot of stress as well. The rent increases that's going on in Manhattan and the New York area is just amazing, and the profit margin that the green grocers are working on is very low. And the workers that we're talking about are basically lower-wage workers. We're not talking about skilled workers here. You have to take that in perspective.
Working first with Local 169 of Unite, Jerry Dominguez is now director of Casa Mexico. He is a representative of the Mexican-American Workers Association and since 1998 has been a lead organizer in what many describe as a militant, contentious green grocer union drive marked by community boycotts, protests, leafleting, and arrests. Dominguez said the union built support worker by worker, store by store, and rejected traditional top-down strategies. For their efforts, the workers have won 10 union contracts since 2000. He added that many in this so-called unskilled labor force were first afraid, but over time learned how to challenge and decode their exploitation.
When it comes to the workers, when we began to organize them, they were chasing us away from their stores. But when we began to educate them, there was a struggle, a process of education about the rights and who they could talk to improve their conditions. And now the workers are the ones that approach us and look, and they already know how to defend themselves. They know where to call, where to go, so on and so forth.
Brad Mayoni is a spokesperson for Attorney General Spitzer. Mayoni said Spitzer took a rare stand for undocumented workers for one simple reason.
The Attorney General's main concern was for the enforcement and equal application of the state's labor law, irrespective of the status of the workers.
Spitzer's office will issue a seal that owners who embrace the code can display in their windows. But Mayoni added that the code does not protect businesses that return to unlawful practices because the Attorney General's office and the independent monitor will be, quote, watching. Calls are now coming in from states like Florida, California, and Connecticut. Calling the new code a milestone in the defense of immigrant labor, supporters expect the agreement could impact millions across the country, to whom Dominguez offered a call to arms.
These times are very difficult for the workers in the United States and all over the world. And there is only one technique or strategy to follow to advance the worker rights, and that means unity.
For Free Speech Radio News in New York, this is Eileen Sutton.
In El Salvador, 30 unionized healthcare workers were fired Wednesday for participating in a one-day strike against privatization earlier this month. The firings were the government's strongest attack in years in its campaign to destroy the union and privatize social security and healthcare in preparation for its participation in international free trade agreements. Carlos Fabara has this report.
To protest these firings, 15 union workers occupied a hospital in San Salvador Thursday night. Hours later, riot police dragged them onto the street, while other workers were held captive at gunpoint by masked agents and beaten.
We are committed to give even our lives, if necessary, to stop Social Security from being privatized. We demand that Social Security not be privatized, but that it be restructured. What is needed is retraining, improved customer service, improved service for women. They don't even provide hospitalization for children.
Elisa Jurado, the president of a Social Security citizens' rights group, at a rally to protest the privatization of Social Security. Congress's recent approval of Fast Track Trade Promotion Authority has given President Bush the green light to begin formal negotiations on CAFTA, the U.S. Central America Free Trade Agreement, with little or no congressional oversight. As the Bush administration moves to extend CAFTA, southern Mexico and Central America's poor are feeling the pain of living on the exploited end of the globalizing economy. For years, El Salvador has been a testing ground for privatization. Since the year 2000, the national currency in El Salvador has been the United States dollar. Emilio Velasco, assistant director of the Social Security Administration, says privatization will improve service. Elisa Jurado says privatization benefits only the political and economic elite at the expense of the general public. Prices soar, working conditions and service declines as businesses put profits strictly before the needs of the public. In August, the Salvadoran government began signing contracts with the owners of the land where the Anillo Periférico, or Salvador Beltway, around the capital is being built. The San Salvador Beltway is an integral part of Plan Puebla Panama, an industrial corridor to connect Mexico, Belize, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, and Panama by means of a four-lane highway. Salvadorian landowners complained that their land is undervalued by the government, and that even when they signed contracts to sell the land where the beltway is being built, they have not been paid. Eduardo Flores, a local accountant, explains.
The government offers to buy the land and houses, but offers to pay less than the market value. After a landowner accepts their offer, they don't even pay.
Recently, 100 people protested against the construction of the Anillo Periférico Beltway by camping for 21 days and sitting in the path of bulldozers. They also planted trees in recently cleared areas. Plan Puebla Panama includes the construction of high-speed rail lines to transport shipping containers across the Central American Isthmus for later distribution to Pacific Rim countries, the U.S. East Coast, and Eastern Europe. Simón Sonseca with CISPES, the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, says people have stood up to say no to these policies.
Organized communities have come out across the country opposed to a free trade agreement with the United States because they know the destruction that it will bring. They've seen the results of NAFTA. They've seen the environmental degradation. They've seen the loss of quality jobs. So trade unions, social movement organizations, organized communities are committed to fighting tooth and nail.
I'm Carlos Favara for Free Speech Radio News.
For years, black leaders and activists have charged that there is a conspiracy against their number, one of the government. While that charge has largely been ignored, there's little question that the media has been the passionate enemy of black leaders. One need look no further than the nearest tabloid.
Political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The media, to paraphrase Marshall McLuhan, is more than the message. It is the social and political entity that defines and affirms social relationships and protects the status quo. It is an essentially conservative institution that opposes that which is radical and that which opposes the status quo. How could any thinking black leader not be radically opposed to the current white supremacist system which degrades, devalues, and limits black life? When any black leader or group emerges that advocates black unity or black power, he or it is undoubtedly a media target. Former reporter and now journalism professor Jack Lewell writes, "Critics long have argued that the news media miss or ignore matters of race because of the overwhelming white face of the nation's newsrooms. Others argue that the news performs a more damaging role. They say that the news media, when they do report on race, foster stereotypes and predominantly offer negative images, such as the portrayal of young black males as criminals and drug users. Black political leaders in particular attract negative coverage, critics say. The news degrades black activists and situates moderate black leaders, or more legitimate, in their words, middle ground. From coverage of Malcolm X to that of the Black Panthers, of Louis Farrakhan, and of Al Sharpton, stories of black leaders who espouse controversial views reflect a troubled relationship among the news, race, and politics." That's from the book Daily News, Eternal Stories, by Jack Lewell. Interestingly, notice how neither Farrakhan nor Sharpton are usually addressed by their religious titles, minister or reverend. When's the last time you read an article that did not address the Reverend Billy Graham? At the beginning of the 20th century, there was considerable criticism of yellow journalism or the practice of sensational, exploitative reporting to hype paper sales. Yellow journalism has been surpassed by an insidious kind of white journalism, where the corporate press acts as a kind of super manager of African-American political, social, and cultural leadership. It disciplines them to stay in their place, to be responsible instead of radical, and God forbid, revolutionary. They perform this service to preserve white supremacy. Black leaders must recognize this assault and resist it. Since when is it the job or responsibility of any predominantly white institution to manage black leaders? What is their expertise? In whose interest do they work? In whose interest have they ever worked? Black leadership is for black people to decide, and that's as it should be. For the corporate white majoritarian media works to preserve the status quo, a status quo that ensures the continued repression and restriction that defines too much of black life in America. And they want to keep it that way. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Free Speech Radio News was produced today out of Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston. Free Speech Radio News is produced by Kata Mesta with assistance from Scott Gurian. Our technical producer is Jade Padgett-Seekins, with assistance from Pauline Bartolone. Our headlines editor is Randy Zimmerman. I'm Deepa Fernandez.